You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, September 18th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
How is everyone this week?
Good.
Pretty good.
Back here at our stations.
That's right, back in the saddle after our slight break after Dragon Con, because we recorded two episodes of Dragon Con.
Yeah, it was a nice break, but it's good to talk to you guys again.
Coolest thing that happened to me in the past 2 weeks, a listener of the show made zombie pictures of us.
Yeah.
Zombie. Yeah, that was so cool.
That Very made cool. my entire month of September.
Bob, you like zombies?
We all came out fantastic. Oh, my God. I want to commission him to do more of me. I'm like, here's X amount of money. I want 3 zombies. I want this one extra decayed.
Oh, my God. Bob. You have to pay him to do like a 4-foot-tall canvas painting of you like posing, you know, like they have in rich people's homes, you know, like you sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
But you're a zombie, but you're wearing like a nice robe, you know, maybe you're petting a cat
who's
also a zombie.
So you can see our zombie portraits
zombie cat.
On Facebook, on our accounts. We have them all there.
But these are for the official AMC Walking Dead trading cards.
Yeah.
And as of now, these are all one-of-a-kind special collector's cards. So you'd have to probably purchase a lot of the Walking Dead trading cards to be lucky enough to get one of our pictures.
And the artist, by the way, is Gary Kazell. We should mention his name.
Yes. He's awesome.
Gary,
super talented.
Totally
I might have mispronounced his last name. Kazell?
Yeah, I thought it was Kazell.
Kazell?
Kazell?
Maybe. I'm going with Kazell.
Gary Kay.
Hey, happy Golden Plate Day, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Golden Plate Day. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Today, September 22nd, 1823, is the day that Joseph Smith definitely, absolutely, for real, walked out into the, to a hill near his house in, Western New York and dug up a stone box that was full of golden books, basically. And on the books were written what came to be known as the Book of Mormon.
Wow.
No one ever actually is sure that the books... I mean, obviously the books existed, because who would lie about something like that? Certainly not a convicted felon like Joseph Smith. But...
that's all in the past now.
He did have, he had 11 men, say that they had actually seen the plates, although it's not too clear if they saw them in person or in magical visions. And,
it doesn't matter.
correct.
Details.
I mean, both of these things count. Yeah. The plates, the writing on the plates, which was the Book of Mormon, the writing was actually not in English, unfortunately. The angels did not write in English. It was written in Reformed Egyptian, which Joseph Smith did not speak or read. However, he had a seer stone, which is a rock that he was previously using to find gold and water, a divining rock of sorts.
Or a dowsing rock.
Yeah. He took the seer stone and he put it in a hat, and then he stuck his head in the hat. He stuck his face in the hat. And,
and let me guess, it said Gryffindor.
Oh boy.
What he saw was, the Book of Mormon in English. He would see it line by line by gazing into the hat, and he would read out what he saw, and someone else wrote it down. And that's how the Book of Mormon came to be. So, happy Golden Plate Day, everybody.
Yeah. I wonder if he knew he was going to win a Tony Award some time later in life.
That was a great show. I saw it last month. It was fantastic.
Did you?
I haven't had a chance to see it yet. Loved it.
Of course, we're talking about the Book of Mormon, the Broadway musical by Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Yeah.
This was the same year, 1827, by the way, that Beethoven died.
Maybe they're related. Maybe the angel that showed him the plates was not Moroni, but was actually the ghost of Beethoven.
Could have been the ghost of Beethoven.
Wow. It's possible. You know what happened when Beethoven died?
He decomposed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know all
the Rebecca,
Christmas
that was
cracker jokes.
Rebecca, you're like the clearinghouse of all jokes that are bad.
Yeah, no, I've heard them all twice. You know, also this day in science history, etc. Happy wow. Hobbit Day. Happy
yes,
Hobbit,
Hobbit
Day, everyone.
Happy
yeah.
birthday to both Frodo and Bilbo.
Yes, unlike the Angel Moroni, these are fictional characters. You might know from J.R.R. Tolkien's books, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And they apparently share a birthday. Although, I think there's a bit of a to-do about this in the Tolkienite circle. Because the Shire calendar does not exactly match up with the Gregorian calendar. And the actual birthday of the Hobbits would be September 12th on our calendar. Or possibly
really?
September 14th. It's unclear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gotta be careful about that though, cause, the Hobbit calendar also predicts the end of the world in, 2015. So.
Ooh.
Right.
Don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's unclear which world, whether or not the
right.
elves will
yeah.
live.
Which age, it could be the, you know.
Yeah, but that age. Is supposed to be on Earth, isn't it?
Well, it's Middle oh. Earth, you know. Another iconic aspect of science fiction is warp drive. Bob, the folks at NASA think that we should actually take warp drive seriously.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's really shocked me. It may actually not be long until we are no longer a pre-warp civilization. Are you guys excited about that?
I don't
Super.
Even believe
Can't
it.
Can't
yet.
Wait.
Yeah.
So some, as Steve said, some NASA scientists are now saying that it could be much easier than we previously thought to create a real warp drive for a spaceship that could speed along at potentially 10 times the speed of light. And regarding this, Harold White of NASA's Johnson Space Center said recently, he said, there is hope. He actually said, there is hope about this. And he said this at the 100-year Starship Symposium, which is kind of like a conference to discuss interstellar spaceflight. He also said, the findings I presented today change it from impractical to plausible and worth further investigation, which shocked the crap out of me because for me, you know, I always thought from what, you know, from what I've read and I've read about this a fair amount was that it was just completely implausible.
Yeah, but Bob, apparently they have this hot young new researcher at NASA called Zefram Cochran, who's been working on it. Comes from this place called Memory Alpha.
Oh, wow, he's got nothing. I mean, there was so many different ways to tackle this one, so I'm going to start with Al Cubierre. He's a physicist who came up with the Alcubierre warp drive idea back in 1994, and he was the first to show that it was at least theoretically feasible and not totally in the realm of fantasy. His idea is interesting. It required a ship surrounded by a ring of exotic matter, which is a form of hypothetical matter with negative, which has many weird attributes, one of them being negative mass, whatever that means. And, so what it would do is it would compress space-time in front of the ship and expand it behind the ship. Meanwhile, the ship itself would be safe and, you know, snug inside this warp bubble thingy, which is composed of flat space-time. So it was relatively safe in there. So this distorted space-time then could propel the ship, apparently, at up to 10 times the speed of light, kind of like riding a really, really fast wave. So the first thing most people should think is, how is this even feasible? I mean, nothing can go faster than light, right? And the answer is, well, yes and no. It depends. Einstein showed us that nothing, matter, energy, information, nothing can go faster than light. But the premise of that statement, though, requires something traveling in space. Space or space-time itself, however, is a different story. It can move relative to other parts of space-time at velocities well above the speed of light. It's not hindered by the speed of light law. For example, there's a few examples that everyone's probably familiar with. The Big Bang and the inflationary period right after the Big Bang. Space-time was expanding for a period of time faster than the speed of light. There's an example right there of something traveling faster than light that's totally okay with the laws of physics. Another way is to think about galaxies that are billions of light years away. They're receding from us faster than the speed of light because of all the space-time between us is expanding. And so let's try this analogy. I thought this one was goofy, but informative analogy. Imagine a rubber band that's like dipped in glue and there's an ant on this rubber band. Now the ant can only go a certain speed because the glue is really slowing him down. But if you expand, if you stretch that rubber band, the ant will move relative to one end of the rubber band faster than he'd ever be able to go in, you know, in local rubber band right. space.
Does the ant have to stretch with the rubber band?
No,
what
no.
A tortured doesn't do it. Analogy, okay, the ant though.
I see what you're saying.
Whatever. All right, so Alcubierre's theory looked good, but it had a major problem. Of course, the energy required to pull this off would be the equivalent of converting the planet Jupiter into energy. Now Jupiter's
Wait,
about...
I thought that the problem with this plan was that it relies on a magical material that doesn't exist.
Well,
isn't that a problem? That
yeah,
seems
that's
like
a
problem.
Pretty troubling
well,
to me as well.
Yeah,
it's like any theory that starts with pretend there's a magical material that doesn't actually exist is going to have a serious, you know, hurdle to overcome.
Well, that's a non-trivial problem.
It is, and it is kind of funny how a lot of the research I did didn't like just totally jump on that. And I think the reason is because exotic matter, you know, they didn't just pull that completely and utterly out of their butts and say, you know, let's have a miracle right here to pull this off. There's, you know, there's some interpretations of some equations where there could be exotic matter. So, I mean, it's not completely, completely fabricated.
It does sound like that Far Side cartoon though. Is it Far Side?
Yeah, yes,
maybe not,
yes.
Where he's like, on the scientist has drawn out all the formulas over the chalkboard and he's like, and here a miracle.
That's a New York cartoon.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
And then a miracle happens. It wasn't a scientist saying, I think you got to flesh out this area a little bit more.
Should be a little bit more explicit in this step. Yeah.
So this is one of the non-trivial problems. You would need so much energy. I mean, we're talking 320 Earths worth of mass, which is approximately 4 × 10²⁸ megatons, which is
so even if you
gargantuan.
Had a 100% efficient matter antimatter drive, that's a huge pile of dilithium crystals you would need.
Yeah, so that besides the exotic matter, Rebecca, that pretty much killed the idea right then.
Blame
and
it there. On me.
I'm just saying.
But recently,
however, new calculations show that it needn't take so much energy. If you change the shape of the ring around the ship into more of a torus or a donut shape, the energy for some reason the energy required drops from a Jupiter-sized amount of energy to the size of the Voyager 1 probe that NASA launched in 1977.
Wow.
Now that's a dramatic reduction, obviously, but we're still, you think about it, we're still talking about 17,000 megatons. Of energy, 17 gigatons of energy, still huge. It's like 3 global thermonuclear wars worth of energy all at once. I mean, it's still, that's gargantuan, but hey, it's a hell of a lot better than Jupiter. And the cool thing is that they've got a way to deal with that potentially as well. It looks like if you oscillate the intensity of the warp space-time around the bubble over time, the energy requirements drop even more. Of course, they're not sure exactly by how much. It could be significant or maybe not so significant, but that's another way that this could be something that's much more manageable. And there's actually, I wasn't aware of this, there's really some really cool byproducts or ramifications of this technology if it's real. So imagine you're in this warp bubble, guys, and there would be no G-forces in the bubble. You're kind of like in free fall for the entire trip. And what that means is that, there'd be no G-forces from acceleration. So you could accelerate at so fast that it would turn you into chunky salsa in a regular spaceship, but because of the way this technology is set up, you wouldn't experience G-forces, which is pretty awesome. The other cool thing, which makes a lot of sense if you think about it, I never thought of this, there'd be tremendous tidal forces at the edge of the bubble, right? Because you'd have these massive curvatures of space. By definition, they're really dramatic curvatures of space, which is essentially, one way to look at what tidal forces are. So, and I was thinking that would make an awesome weapon, right? Shoot this thing at a ship or even a planet, and the tidal forces would just rip anything apart that it comes close to. So, I'm just throwing that out there. So, another downside though is
I'm glad that you've already created this in your head. There's this peaceful technology, and you've already made it into a weapon. Good job.
Hey,
not just a weapon, a doomsday machine.
Yeah.
How do we get one of these doomsday machines?
And you know what's funny? I was thinking about it. 10 times the speed of light. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. But that's really not that fast if you think about it. It's only about warp factor 2 in using the Star Trek way of reckoning speed, which, you know, warp 2 is cool and all, but the Enterprise never really traveled anywhere at a pokey warp 2. It's always like warp 8, warp 9, we got to get there fast. Still, yeah, we could go to the closest stars, but it's not like we're going to go terribly far. It would still take a long time.
Wait. Hold on a second.
What?
Wait. As geek culture really, have we dropped so low? Are we actually at that point that literally, like, the moment that a scientist says, you know what, we probably might be able to do this, you're already going, well, you know, 2 times the speed of light isn't really that great.
Breaking
the speed of light, Bob.
Jay, it's not really breaking the speed of light.
Yes, it is. It is,
but it's not breaking any laws of physics. And Jay, I'm just putting it in perspective.
But from a perspective where, hey, how long would it take you to get from here to there? It is breaking the speed of light. And what I'm saying is that you just reduced it down to basically like a, it's not good enough routine. It is good enough. It's fantastic.
Yeah, Bob,
we could get
to other stars in months. As opposed to tens of thousands of years.
I know. Of course, it's fantastic, and I would be the first one on that damn ship. Well, maybe the second one after they test it out. Yeah, of course it is. But I'm just saying, putting it into perspective, it's really, you know, it's not like we can circumnavigate the galaxy like Star. It's not Star Trek. Warp 2.
Rebecca, give him an inch, he wants the galaxy.
I know, he's the embodiment of that Louis C.K. bit where it's like everything is a wonderful and nobody's happy.
I love him. I just started watching him on Netflix. He totally rocks.
Well,
Bob, don't worry about that. They'll test that thing out on monkeys and people that wear glasses first.
Well, guys, it's not going to happen. All right. I'm putting my dollar down.
We're not 5 to 10 years away from this is what you're saying.
There's tons of other things that scientists call non-trivial problems besides the exotic matter. Even if the energy requirements weren't that bad, there's still some big problems here. For example, to generate the warp bubble, it seems like the exotic matter would have to move locally at faster than light speeds, and that's not going to happen. So that could potentially be bad. And also this would require tachyons to exist, which is bad because I don't think tachyons exist. Those, you've heard of them. They're hypothetical particles that travel greater than the speed of light. They never go slower than the speed of light. They always go faster than the speed of light. And check this out. If you could figure out a way of producing tachyons which don't exist, then that might mean that a singularity might appear in front of your ship. So, okay, I got a black hole in front of my ship now. So it's all these weird problems that crop up. Oh, and listen to this one. If you throw in quantum mechanics, some cool scientist looked at this and added quantum mechanics to the whole mix. And he said, wait a second. If we do this, then Hawking radiation is going to fry any body or anything inside of the bubble. And the list goes on and on. There's all these huge potential problems.
Now, that's for the engineers to worry about.
Yeah. So, in my opinion, the scientists that are pushing this seem a little overly optimistic. They're actually starting lab experiments. They've actually started to do, of course, very small-scale lab experiments to see if they could find a hint of this possibility. So I think it still seems incredibly over-optimistic for lots of reasons, some of which I've mentioned. So I don't expect to see warp drive and greater than light speed in the near future, but I'm still holding out hope that before I die, we'll be able to at least hit ludicrous speed.
Ludicrous the rapper?
No. Come on,
Spaceballs.
Help me out here, Steve. Yeah, Evan. Yeah.
Spaceballs. We need to get the infinite improbability drive.
Well, yeah.
To bypass all these problems. But, Bob, you know.
Small steps.
They're planning on thinking about doing experiments on these warp bubbles in the lab. This is one of those things where it may not lead to the precise technology that we envision, you know, a starship and warp drive, but something else interesting and potentially
some off-label
game changing may come out of that.
Right. No, that's true. I didn't think
probably
of that.
Probably a weapon.
Yeah. If we get a cool weapon out of it, then I'll be happy. That's true. Who
you
knows
Americans
what kind of
point it that way.
we cannot allow a warp bubble gap.
Thank you, Scott.
God,
I was waiting
God
for that
no.
One.
We have to figure this out before somebody else does.
So what do you think? We got about 4 or 5 movies in there? I think that's good.
That's good enough. We hit our quota already. Hit our quota early this episode.
Yeah, might as well just pack it in.
All right, let me talk about some bad science reporting, some bad science news reporting, which we do talk about quite a bit on this show because it happens all the time. There was a recent study that came out looking at the source of bad science news reporting. Bad operationally defined as spin, meaning a significant alteration in the interpretation of a study. In other words, if the study was either weakly positive or even neutral or whatever, that the news reporting reported it as being a lot more definitive or positive than it actually was. And they looked at three layers. They looked at the original article, specifically the conclusion in the abstract of the technical article relating the research. They looked at the press release, which is often generated by a press officer, as that's part of whatever institution the researchers were from or the funding organization, whatever, whoever thinks they can promote their group or institution by promoting the research. And then at the mainstream, you know, news media reporting of those stories. And they found a couple of things that were fairly interesting. One is no surprise, and that is a lot of news stories are distorted, are had quote unquote spin. But they, what they did find was a significant correlation between overselling the findings of the study in the original abstract and the presence of spin in the press release and the news, subsequent news reporting. So the original spin propagated through the next two layers, the being magnified each step of the way. So the researchers of this article put a lot of the blame for hype in science news reporting on the researchers themselves, not necessarily the journalists. This doesn't let them off the hook. I think it does, in my opinion, emphasize that scientists need to be aware of the, of what they're writing, what they're saying to the media, of what they're putting in their abstract, and that this is having an influence on the way science is being represented and reported to the public.
Steve, maybe they think they do. Maybe they think they're getting the right points across or putting it in the proper context, but they're just, you know, they just don't really don't know how to do it.
So I think there's a couple of sources of the spin in the abstracts of the articles. One is that the scientists are actually overinterpreting their results. They, this is just researcher bias. You know, my results are game changing. They're really important. They are, you know, the effect that I was looking for is really real and robust, you know, rather than, you know, the results are mediocre, ambiguous, not that significant, not that robust. Researcher bias, wanting the results to be more impressive. I think the second is researchers who know that they're overselling the results, but are doing so in order to garner attention to their research. This is the space dinosaur effect, right? This is, you know, we talked about the guy who was writing about the chirality of amino acids in asteroids and somehow concluded with there are hyper-intelligent space dinosaurs out there.
I'd be interested in seeing a related study that looks at scientists who exaggerate in their abstract or misrepresent their conclusions and who is getting the press, who the mainstream media is actually reporting on. Because, I mean, I would guess that the people who are exaggerating are the ones that are getting the mainstream press, which provides sort of a feedback loop of sorts you know, it's a reward system for misrepresenting their own data.
Yeah.
That's actually depressing, because if that's really the case, then I don't see this changing anytime soon. I mean, that's just human nature. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you stop that?
There's a culture in science, and reputation is huge in science. If, you know, if there was negative backlash against researchers for overhyping their own results, which there is, you know, within the culture of science, if it were more significant, I think that could have, you know, a feedback effect and reduce it. And also, you know what? That the spin got past peer reviewers. So right there, you know, in peer review is imperfect, but peer reviewers should be paying more attention to overhyping the results. And you often see that the peer review process does have an effect. And we write about this and talk about this all the time, like on science-based medicine. I know David Gorski has made this observation a lot. I've made this observation a lot. You see what the researchers are telling the press and what, and the popular articles they're writing about their research. And then you read the published research and it's much more sedate. Because, well, I bet you it was a lot better, more hyped in the original version, and then some peer reviewers said this, you know, your conclusions are not justified by your data, scale it back. So that filter is there, but the filter needs to be better. And editors need to be paying more attention to that. Reviewers need to be paying more attention to it. But the other thing is, the journalists were propagating forward the spin almost without filter. This is why I don't let the journalists off the hook. They weren't doing their job. Yeah. So even if they weren't the source of the spin, they weren't doing their job of being journalists. They were just, you know, propagating forward the press releases. They weren't talking to other scientists to say, hey, are these guys full of shit? Or is this real? I mean, what do you think about this other guy's research? Are they overselling themselves?
Yeah.
How about, get an objective source. And good journalists do this. But we're seeing, you know, the rank and file probably not trained as a science journalist, you know, because of the whole collapse of the news reporting infrastructure, you know, which we've talked about. They're not doing their job. So they're just, you know, sometimes just copying forward the press releases. Probably the only people in this equation who are doing their job doesn't let them off the hook either. But the people who are writing the press releases, it is their job to get attention to the research. That's what they're supposed to be doing. And if they're just propagating the spin that the researchers did, I mean, they're not journalists. They're marketers. So even though it is distasteful that they're also carrying forward this spin, they're actually the only ones who are doing their jobs because they're marketers. The scientists are scientists. The journalists are journalists. They're the ones who I give the most blame to. They're the ones who are not supposed to be selling hype. They're supposed to be.
Well, unfortunately, the new job description of journalists isn't doing journalism. It's selling newspapers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the problem.
That's why this happens. Yeah.
How about this, Steve? As part of the education, when you get towards, you know, you get closer to your PhD or your master's or whatever, do they even have like a class on how to deal with the media? I mean, that could be invaluable, I would think.
No, it's the kind of thing you picked up through mentorship, you know?
I think some colleges are doing that now.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they're starting to do that now because there is more attention being paid to this. We had someone on our show, if you recall, from the organization promoting this and, you know, involved in the book, A Guide for Scientists to Talk to the Media. So there are efforts in this direction, but my experience is that it's still has a very low penetrance. It's still very much a new thing. And most working scientists out there probably have not had formal education in how to deal with the media. And you see it. I mean, we talk about these news stories all the time where some naive researcher, you know, for whatever reason, their obscure research thrusts them into the media and they're completely unprepared for it. And nonsense ensues. No matter how obscure you think your research is, that may happen to you. You may write something in your abstract that some press officer picks up on and suddenly it's got national news. I think this happened collectively to climatologists as a profession. Suddenly global warming was the biggest controversy on the planet. And here you have these, you know, climatologists who never got the time of day from the media. You know, we're getting all this attention and they weren't quite sure how to deal with it collectively. So, I do think as a profession, and this is under the broader concept of scientists need to learn how to popularize and the necessity, the benefits of popularizing their science. Still very variable. A lot of my colleagues think it's distasteful or that they think that they do it because once a year they take an interview from a reporter or something. But, you know, I don't think they understand how vitally important communicating science to the public is.
You know, I almost think though that in relation to this study, the takeaway is really more about the pressures we put on scientists to produce work that's going to capture headlines.
Yeah.
And, you know, as opposed to doing just good, solid work, trying to find results that aren't there, you know, trying to get into newspapers. That shouldn't be scientists' job.
Yeah, no, I agree. Scientists have to get grants. Journals want their impact factor. They want to get in the news too. So there's motivations up and down the chain to showcase research and to maybe make it look a little bit more exciting than it is. At the end of the day, you know, I think experts and scientists recognize what's real and what's hype, and then we have to keep that check in place, you know? Okay, well, let's move on to the next item. Jay, you're going to tell us about the dark energy camera.
Yeah, the camera is the result of 8 years of a collaborative effort between scientists, engineers, and technicians over three continents. And the basic question that the camera is trying to answer is, why is the expansion of the universe speeding up? So with that as the original premise, it's a pretty big question to ask, and it's been one that's been vexing scientists for a very long time. And it's really requiring us to find out more detailed information about what is the universe, what's in the universe. And the camera is a 570 megapixel camera, and they took the first picture on September 12th, and a man named James Segrist, who's the Associate Director of Science for High Energy Physics with the U.S. Department of Energy, said, "The results of this survey will bring us closer to understanding the mystery of the dark energy and what it means for the universe."
So this is the highest resolution camera ever built.
Absolutely, by a long shot. The dark energy camera was constructed at the U.S. Department of Energy and the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Illinois. And the camera was mounted onto a Victor M. Blanco telescope, which you should look up if you want details on that. This entire thing is around the size of a phone booth, if anyone remembers what a phone booth is. And it's in Chile right now. So it, of course, is the most powerful survey instrument of its kind. And it's able to see light from over 100,000 galaxies and up to 8 billion light years away in each snapshot, which is a huge, huge increase from any of its predecessors. What's even more interesting is that the astronomical community can gain access to this device and use it through the National Optical Astronomy Observatory's Open Access Telescope Allocation Program, which basically means that they can put in a request to use it, and time is being allocated to other institutions and groups that want to do different things. So it's not only going to be used to explore dark matter, but it will also be used to do things like study asteroids in our solar system, and also incredibly profound things like helping us understand the origins and the fate of our own universe. So first off, very impressive project. Took 8 years. They pulled it together. The thing seems to be working great. It's going to be in full effect in December of this year, and I'm looking forward to seeing these pictures.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
If I used it to take bird pictures, then I wouldn't have to get close at all. I could take like just a picture of my backyard, and there'd be like dozens of birds I can have close-up photos of.
Wow, that's a stupid use of an awesome technology.
I know, Steve.
Way to find the most boring use for that. Good job.
Birds, come on.
Steve's like, I could zoom in from a bird in California.
Now imagine you have a picture. It'd be like on a Blade Runner where you have a picture and you could zoom in and keep zooming
Don't call forth the name Blade Runner in a vain attempt to make your stupid idea sound cooler. God.
I completely agree, Steve. First of all, that technology in Blade Runner. I'm not done. That technology in Blade Runner, which Rebecca, I'm sure, remembers because she got angry at you the same instant I did, it can look around corners, okay? This thing can't do that. It could actually go, yeah, it could, so please, don't go there.
Anyway, what the camera's actually going to do, if I read this correctly, is just taking a really detailed survey of lots of galaxies and galaxy clusters.
Millions.
And it'll be looking, you know, surveying them and looking at how, I guess, they move over time. And that's going to be the primary information that it's going to be collecting.
Yeah, that sounds accurate. It's also important to note that they're going to be using it for a lot of other things that aren't as profound as that. I mean, it's going to be great to look up close at other big objects.
All right. Well, Rebecca, tell us about crowdsourcing science.
There is apparently a new project called Crowdsourcing Discovery, and it's been launched by two researchers, one Ethan Perlstein, or maybe Perlstein, I don't know, at Princeton University. He studies how drugs work, and David Solzer, who has a lab at Columbia Med School, and he studies how drugs affect the brain. And now the labs are joining together in order to solve the mystery of how amphetamines actually work. Because even though people take those drugs all the time, apparently the actual science of how they do what they do is lacking. So that's what these labs want to study. And they are launching this thing, crowdsourcing discovery. And my issue with this, I tried to get as much information about this as I could, but it was rather difficult, other than an event that is happening, which I will plug for them, Thursday, October 4th, in New York City at Dewey's Flatiron. New York skeptics know where that is because they meet there quite often, actually, at 7 p.m. So they have an event listening for this, and they describe the research that they've done and the research that they hope to do. And they say, since this is uncharted territory, meaning how these drugs affect the brain, we don't know for sure where this will end up, which means that you get to experience the thrill of discovery as it occurs. So it's not really clear whether or not they're just looking for money or whether they're looking for true citizen science type stuff. But I took particular issue with something in their event details. They say, and I quote, "The web itself, the fruit of curiosity-driven basic research, has transformed every industry and creative endeavor it has touched, promoting collaboration, openness, and efficiency. But scientists are stuck in a closed, pre-internet mindset. We aim to change that." All right. That is like so completely wrong that it couldn't possibly be wronger. There are tons of researchers out there that are using citizen science. In fact, if you Google citizen science, you will find them, things like Foldit, things like Galaxy Zoo. These researchers are utilizing people at home, not for funding, but for actual hands-on research help. And it's working out quite well. So scientists aren't stuck in pre-internet mindsets, although I get the feeling that these scientists are, because I can't find any website for crowdsourcing discovery. I can't find any other information about it. Like, there's no information on what they're looking for exactly. Are they looking for money? Are they looking for hands-on research akin to Foldit or Galaxy Zoo? I do not know. I support citizen science stuff, and I support crowdsourcing. And I think that you can do really fantastic things. I know Discover Magazine blogs has one you can sign up to that just alerts you for citizen scientist opportunities. And they can be things as simple as, you know, if you live in New England, go outside and look in your yard and tell us what bugs you find. Upload pictures and descriptions. And that helps researchers figure out what bugs are where, what invasive species are moving in, things like that. So there are a lot of really great citizen science stuff, and it sounds like this could be really exciting. Unfortunately, there's not a ton of information. So maybe somebody wants to go to the kickoff party and report back. I don't live in New York, but I do have several friends who do, so maybe I'll send them over.
Now, yeah, I assume this was for funding.
That's what it seemed like to me, too.
Actually, okay, so it says, "Using the internet, we will enable the public to fund and participate in a basic research project at an unprecedented level." So yes, they are looking for funding, and apparently some sort of hands-on work, but they don't say what. And also they don't say why. I mean, if this research is so important, which it sounds like it is, why can't they pursue funding from other sources? It'd be nice to know. I mean, I don't question the fact that it's very difficult for researchers to find funding. However, it would be nice to know, you know, what funding they did pursue, how much they need, things like that. But maybe this kickoff is meant to brainstorm on things like that and start setting up a website for it.
It seems to be like right at the very beginning of it. Yeah. My reaction was, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, but I do think that, funding for scientific research is really decreasing, especially recently. And researchers are finding it harder and harder to get grants. You know, a smaller percentage of grants are being funded. You know, I think that it would be really interesting to pursue this kind of idea. You know, we just completed a Kickstarter campaign for our SGU video project, and there are people who are finding lots of funding for projects, you know, essentially by crowdsourcing on the internet, that maybe would otherwise not have been funded. Why not use that to fund scientific projects? The potential upside is that it would involve people in research. It would be a good connection between the public and scientific researchers. It'll give the public a bit of a direct say. You could vote with your dollars directly rather than through some government agency. in terms of what to fund. And this may, you know, funnel a lot more funding into scientific research. The downside, as I see it, is that the public gets to decide what gets funded. And that's a problem, because then it becomes a popularity contest rather than more of an expert analysis of getting the most bang for the buck. You know, like which research projects are really likely to bear fruit and are worth investing. So I could see that a lot of nonsense and pseudoscience would get funded through that kind of process. But, it's kind of like this, like everything with the internet, you get less of the traditional expert filters and you get more democracy, which means there's going to be a lot more crap. But it's also an opportunity for a lot of merit-based success, you know. So I think that in terms of like social media, a lot of people who may not have gotten through the traditional barriers of editors and publishers, et cetera, were able to rise to the top just on, based upon the quality of their work. But of course, they're floating on top of a sea of a lot of mediocrity and crap. And the same thing would be true of, I think, any just open funding of projects like scientific research. But it would be a really interesting experiment to do. What would be the result if you had a Kickstarter for scientific research? You know, I think that's an experiment that somebody's going to do eventually.
But then how do you control for, you know, what if William Morris donates all the money you need for your Kickstarter to do your study on the effects of tobacco?
Then that's a problem. You're right. That's a problem.
The trick is that you can't use this to bypass the law. So if you're going to be doing research on humans, even though you're funding it through a Kickstarter type internet campaign, you still have to get an IRB approval and follow the law in terms of doing human research.
Yeah.
You still have to be transparent in terms of your funding resources. And your funding sources and declare any conflicts of interest. And so all of that still needs to come into play. Even it's just, you know, the only difference is that you're not going to the NIH with a grant proposal. You're just telling the public, here's why my research is interesting. This is why you should fund me, and then see what happens. I don't know. I honestly don't know if it's going to be like a net positive or negative, to be honest with you. I think it's interesting, and I think it's an experiment that should be done and probably will be at some point.
Well, right now they've only sold 3 tickets to their launch party.
Gotta start somewhere.
They just sold another one since we've been recording this?
No, one of them bought 2 tickets.
Well, the tickets are free.
So maybe
3 free tickets.
Maybe we can send some listeners their way to help out and report back.
Evan, you're going to tell us about blueberries on Mars.
Yeah, well, you know, there are apparently blueberries on Mars, but not really. Hey, we've been talking a lot about Curiosity, the Mars rover that recently landed on Mars, but we can't forget its older brother, Opportunity, mm-hmm. which landed in 2004. And it's still going strong. I mean, yeah. eight and a half years. Let's talk about that aspect alone. It's supposed to be a 90-day mission, right? 3 months. Send this thing to Mars, works for 9 months, right? Works for 3 months, mission accomplished, right? This thing has been going on for 8.5 years.
I think they underestimate.
I'm sure they purposely underestimated a bit, but that's a lot.
I thought about that.
8 years is crazy.
Call it the Scotty factor, right? In which Scotty says, this will take 8 weeks to fix, and he fixes it in like 2 days. So, right? So, total underestimation of the potential. It's fascinating. It's a great story. Great story for NASA. Great story for, our history of exploring Mars. Nothing bad. But perhaps, 8.5 years later, of course, since it landed, an Opportunity is still finding things, and they're saying that it's taken one of the most extraordinary pictures of the whole mission in that time just recently. So we know that there are these sphericals, these little tiny, well, spheres on Mars, which they have dubbed blueberries, and they were discovered near the Opportunity landing site. Now, these ones that were originally found way back when, they were iron-rich spheres and probably made of hematite.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that suggests Mars was once water-rich environment to have created this, because we've seen these on Earth as well in dry lake beds out in Nevada and other places. So there's a bit of a comparison there. But only recently has Opportunity discovered a new different kind of spheres that are not iron-rich composites. They're made of, well, something else. And that's the mystery. That's the curiosity, to borrow the title of the other rover. And they're saying that they are different in concentration. These spheres are different in structure. They're different in composition. And they're different in distribution. And that's according to but otherwise they're entirely the same. That was said by Opportunity's principal investigator Steve Squires of Cornell University out in Ithaca, Carl Sagan's old stomping grounds. So, legitimate mystery on our hands as to what are these things. They describe them as having sort of a crunchy texture on the outside, yet sort of
creamy filling.
What else could they possibly be? Start thinking about
alien artifacts.
Well, that's, or seeds, little seeds of some sort, in which, you know, things are bound to spring out. Someone lost their marbles or ball bearings on Mars, yeah.
It's a mystery.
It is a mystery.
All right. Well, if NASA figures out what these things are, we'll keep you updated.
Yep. We'll have a new report.
One last news item, just a quick announcement, actually. Reminder that the entire SGU crew will be at SciCon in Nashville, Tennessee, October 25th to 28th. We're going to be doing a live show from SciCon on Thursday night, the 25th. And then on Saturday night, we will be doing an SGU dinner. So if you will be in the area, be attending SciCon, don't also remember to sign up, to separate sign up for the SGU dinner. They have a lot of great speakers there. Very impressive lineup. In addition to us, they have James Alcock, PZ Myers, Joe Nickel, Kimball Atwood, Massimo Polidoro, George Robb, David Gorski, the entire CSI crew, of course, will be there. John Ronson, Richard Reisman, Eugenie Scott, Carol Tavris.
Wow, that's a hell of a crew.
That's an impressive lineup. That's a nice lineup.
It's going to be a fun convention.
I cannot wait. And there's the big Halloween party. They're offering, you have to dress up. I mean, you don't have to, but you have to dress up. And they're offering a prize to anyone who can psychically predict what costume CFI CEO Ron Lindsay will be wearing. Last year he wore I thought it was like a Nazi commander thing, but he insists that it was, he looked really offended that I thought that. And then he told me no, he's actually dressed as a South American dictator.
Okay. No, not a Nazi, a South American dictator.
Well, the next Nazi. Flee to South America. Yeah, exactly.
He's promised that this costume will be more chipper though. So use that when you're considering your guesses.
Buenos noches, mein Führer.
But yeah, that was an absolute blast last year. I can't wait. And also don't forget that if you live between Nashville and Buffalo, New York, Richard Wiseman, John Ronson, and I will be on a road trip going down, stopping off at various places. You can find out more at paranormalroadtrip.org.
I don't know about Rebecca, but the other four of us are still trying to decide on our costumes, and we're taking requests. So if you have any ideas for what costume you want us to wear, then just email us and we'll take it into consideration. No promises.
The theme is, I think the theme is going to be like, zombie cowboys.
What?
That doesn't mean you have to dress up like that, but I think
I could totally work that.
I'll be a zombie Indian. People chase me around. Well, kind of
no shit.
I just feel like because I'm hosting it, I should probably adhere to the theme.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thank you for the reminder, Steve. I appreciate that every week.
I know you forget.
I'm very forgetful when it comes to this, and I don't understand why. I must have a mental block made of concrete. But in any case, you are right. I will play for you, the Who's That Noisy from a couple of episodes ago. See if you remember this one.
It's a lot to take in. You know, werewolves, ghosts, vampires. They didn't believe in homeopathy before this.
I know who that is.
Yeah, Rebecca, help us out with this one. Give us some details.
That's What's Her Chunk from
What's
from
Her Grill?
Being Human.
You are correct. Being Human is the television series that was taken from. The actress's name is Sinead Keenan, and she played the role of werewolf Nina Pickering on this supernatural drama, which airs on BBC Three.
Well, there was also, I think Sci-Fi or someone made an American version that actually wasn't too bad. I don't know if it's still on, but.
Did anybody get that correct, Evan?
Oh, yeah, we had several correct guesses, but the person who guessed correctly first was Rhiannon Davies from the United Kingdom. Well done, Rhiannon. Congratulations.
And I did just check, and it is still on, by the way, the U.S.
Very cool. Sci-Fi, you say. Sci-Fi Network.
Yeah. Syfy.
Syfy. The Syfy. They had a show on there called SGU once, I think, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's
after
gone.
Us.
Let us never speak of it again.
I want to send a thank you to Tree Lobsters for providing us with that clip. So thank you very much.
Tree Lobsters, who blogs for Mad Art Lab.
Hey, hey.
And therefore, what do you got for this week?
For this week, we've got something. Well, I'll let you listen for yourself. You be your own judge of exactly what is this noisy. Here it comes. All right.
That was it.
That's it.
Some Jaws.
That's it. Well, I can't say you're right, but I can say you're wrong.
Okay.
Okay. So,
give us your best guess, folks. Our email is info@theskepticsguide.org. Our forums is sguforums.com. Feel free to give us your guess. And as I say every week, and I mean this with all my heart and my soul, good luck.
Good luck, everybody.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Oh, sorry, Evan. I get so excited.
We have a couple of corrections this week, one from each of the two live shows that we did at DragonCon. The first one is deals
Suck
with
it up. Oh,
the blue moon. Remember, we had a quick discussion of the blue moon. And both of these corrections also just come from the folks on the SGU forums, also to collectively give them credit for bringing this up. So I mentioned the fact that you were talking about the lunar hypothesis about, you know, the lunar effect of people going crazy or more animal bites or whatever on the full moon, and the evidence doesn't support any such effect. But it was a blue moon at the end of August this year, in that it was the second full moon in a given calendar month. However, several people pointed out that the original definition of a blue moon was something a little bit different. It was, in fact, the third full moon in a season that has four full moons. Do you guys know that?
No.
Yes, I knew that.
Well,
and when they had said, this came up, I think, the last time we brought up the blue moon. I think I just forgot that we were corrected on this previously. The reason that it has such an obscure meaning is because this was used for ecclesiastical calendar making, you know, knowing when, for example, the date of Easter should be in a given year. So it's an obscure meaning for an obscure use. The newer definition of the second full moon in the calendar month was inadvertently introduced by Sky and Telescope. They refer to this themselves as a quote-unquote mistake, but then it became the more generally accepted definition of a blue moon. You know, this creates, of course, the traditionalist versus use argument of, well, what's the real definition of a blue moon? Is it the original definition or the one that most people think it is? What criterion do you use?
And the answer is yes.
Yeah, the answer is, yeah, whatever you want. This is not a scientific definition, right? It's not as if it means something about the universe. This is purely a cultural construct, you know, again, invented initially for the ecclesiastical calendar and now has a colloquial or more folk or common meaning. Both are equally valid, in my opinion. The second full moon in a calendar month is a little bit easier. They both retain the original meaning. Actually, the term blue moon predates both of those interpretations, both of those definitions. The term was borrowed for that original ecclesiastical use, but there are older references referring to a rare event, you know, once in a blue moon. And both of those events, you know, the third full moon in the season with four or the second in a month, both occur, you know, roughly every 2 to 3 years or so, a rarish event. So making the saying once in a blue moon, you know, appropriate in either case. So there is precedent for the saying even before that ecclesiastical use. So no right or wrong answer to this one, in my opinion. But yes, there is that. It is more complicated, as is often the case. The second one involves Francis Kelsey. If you remember, Francis Kelsey, I mentioned, was the person working at the FDA who was solely responsible for refusing approval for thalidomide and thereby preventing the horrible birth defects from occurring to Americans while the drug was being used for pregnancy, for morning sickness and pregnancy over in Europe and in other countries. Do you guys know what mistake I made when talking about Francis Kelsey?
Was it that you called her a man?
Yep, that's it. Frances Kelsey is in fact a woman, and I can say is because she is still alive.
Awesome.
She's get her on the show.
She's 98 years old.
Oh, she can use Skype.
She was born July 24th, 1914. She's still around.
Dang.
Wow. Steve, if it's possible, we really should interview her.
If it's possible, yeah, that would be awesome. So, interestingly, reading up on her history, after getting her degree in pharmacology, she applied for graduate work at the University of Chicago, and the director, E.M.K. Gilling, G-E-I-L-I-N-G, assumed that Francis was a man, and she accepted the position without ever clarifying her gender.
Good for her.
So
screw them.
I wasn't the first one to mistake Francis, the androgynous name, for a guy.
Like, but that's actually pretty cool that she didn't let the guy know that it was a woman, and what, she just show up for work one day and they're like,
I guess so. And what you say, it doesn't matter, and it shouldn't matter.
No, so, I know it doesn't matter, Steve, but yeah, on paper it doesn't matter, but you know,
but this was 1936.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what, today it's even less relevant, but back in the day, I mean, they must have been like, what? You know, what are you, the guy's wife? Like, what's going on? She's like, I don't think so.
We gotta be careful though. The last time I mentioned that an androgynous name might be female, we got hate mail calling me a feminazi.
What?
So careful there.
And you were also wrong, Rebecca, about the word pedantic, so don't you forget it.
Oh, I take it back. That's my thing. No, that wasn't an email. That was
Yeah, Rebecca, didn't you see my email where I'm like, no, I think you got it right, Rebecca. Nothing, no response.
Yeah. No, he did respond to me, and someone wrote in and suggested that I, and wanted to inform me that the correct pronunciation was pedantic, that there was only one N in pedantic. And I responded and said, thanks, maybe you should listen to that episode a little more carefully. And he responded and said, I already did.
Cutting.
Wow.
And I responded to that saying, you know, I can't tell if you get the joke or not, but thanks. Because anyway, he might get the joke. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he's just being even drier than I could be.
Yeah, you never know, right? I mean,
it's
how
possible.
Do you know? Yeah, but, you know, we have so many listeners that it's frequent that people misunderstand the sequence of our banter and like reply to us about something that nobody ever said or just didn't get what we were talking about. But when you correct them and then they double down, it's like, no, this is what you said.
Yeah.
I was there.
Doubled down. Yeah. And then they sign. Love the show anyways.
Yeah.
But you know, usually that tactic works on me because I'm always like, well, I guess I'm just misremembering. I probably said something stupid and I don't remember. So
yeah, see, like, I record the show.
I totally give them the benefit of the doubt.
And then I edit the show. And so I'm far more intimate with every word that goes on the show. So I generally do remember those details.
How about like 3 minutes ago when Rebecca said pronunciation?
Yeah.
Wait.
Jay, what movie, what word did you
I don't think
botch?
I said that.
No, you did. You did. I've been laughing with my headset turned off like loudly. Yes.
Yeah. I said pronunciation?
Yes.
You did. I picked up on it as
really?
Well.
Really?
Yep.
Did I?
Yep.
Ding. See what I mean? That's why I just give people the benefit of the doubt.
We can convince you of anything, in other words.
Yeah. I don't know.
All right. Well, thanks for those corrections, our vigilant forum posters.
Yeah.
Well, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Straight up science or fiction this week. Is everybody ready?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Ready to go.
Okay, no theme. Here we go. A new study finds that more than 30% of patients who meet strict criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome are infected with the XMRV virus. Item number two, Russian scientists announce an earlier discovery of a massive deposit of diamonds estimated at trillions of carats, or 10 times existing world reserves, in a large Siberian meteor crater. Item number three, a large study of SAT scores finds that they are good predictors of later college performance across socioeconomic status. This week you guys don't get the benefit of all riding on my coattail, so you're on your own.
Oh my god.
Give me it.
Wow.
Break.
How did we survive without you? Oh, shit. I shouldn't say
insufferable.
All right, I was going to make the person who complained the most go first, but you were all pretty equal. So, but Jay,
wow.
Jay was the loudest, so Jay, you go first.
That was loud? If I'm going to get penalized for complaining, let me complain again. Okay. So that first one about the people with chronic fatigue syndrome were infected with an actual virus. XMRV virus. But the thing that's interesting is it says only about 30% of the patients who meet the strict criteria. And that's interesting because I would imagine that chronic fatigue is one of those nebulous things like, oh, I'm dizzy. You know, like a million things can make people have chronic fatigue. A lot of things at the very least. You know, why wouldn't a virus be one of them? And I think this is a pretty interesting idea and it makes sense. Okay. I like that one. The second one is about the diamonds, about this huge vat of diamonds in Siberia, in a Siberian meteor crater. That's awesome. 10 times the existing world reserves. Yeah, that's certainly possible. Like, doesn't seem crazy. Sure, there could have been a huge deposit of diamonds somewhere. Somebody found them, and there you go. Who owns it, Steve? Russian scientists? This guy doesn't own it. That's like, sounds like something the Russian mob will get their hands on. Anyway, okay, I have no reason to doubt that one. The last one about the SAT scores being a predictor of later performance. Yeah, I could see that, but I could also see how that could be wrong as well. And out of the three of them, this one seems the least likely in my opinion. So I'm going to say that one is true, and then I'm going to have to go back to the other two, and I will say that. Son of a gun, I'm going with the SAT ones as the fake.
SAT or the fake.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
All right. Bob, you go next.
These are real good, Steve. These are excellent. I could have a problem with any of them. All right, let's see. 30% chronic fatigue syndrome patients are infected with this virus. 30%, that's a perfect percentage. You know, it's not crazy. It's not too much. It's not like 45 or 50%, but it's not too tiny. Ugh. That's frustrating. Yeah, I'm gonna. God, viruses just can cause so many different things. Yeah, I'm gonna have to tentatively go with that one. The SAT ones, yeah, that makes sense. But like Jay said, you could also see how it doesn't. But I'm gonna say that one's okay as well because the second one, the diamonds, is totally rubbing me the wrong way. Come on, 10 times the world reserves is gargantuan. That, I mean, I hate to resort to this, but that would be plastered everywhere. And I think De Beers would rather start the zombie apocalypse than let this news get out.
Bob, so, what about the Bears?
The Bears. And the icing on the cake, they find it in a meteor crater.
Cake.
I guess it's possible that there's a lot of diamonds that are very low quality and it doesn't matter, but that's not enough to make me not choose that one as the fiction.
Diamonds are the fiction.
Yes.
Okay. Evan.
Chronic fatigue syndrome, huh? Steve, you've blogged about this before. I don't remember you blogging anything recently about it. And something with having to do with virus. But I can't say for sure. I just can't remember exactly which viruses you were talking about, Steve, when you were blogging about it. I seem to recall it was something different, which leads me to believe that there may be multiple viruses that are perhaps associated with CFS. If there are multiple viruses that can relate to this, then that would kind of cut away at a larger percentage of patients. So that's my vector on that one. The massive deposit of diamonds. Wow, trillions of carats. Well, I guess, you know, you got a meteor coming down and impact and the heat and the carbon and the compression. And I think that part of it's very plausible. So that's a maybe. And then the SAT scores being good predictors of later college performance. I was kind of leaning with Jay, maybe thinking that this one's going to wind up being the fiction.
Come on, commit.
I'll go with my first instinct, Steve, which is the chronic fatigue syndrome. I think multiple viruses perhaps are in play here, and therefore I think that 30% is an accurate number. So that's my play there. I'll say that that one's fiction.
So even spread, Rebecca.
All right.
Bust us up.
As for, yeah, multiple viruses possibly being the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome, I think Evan is correct in that multiple viruses have been identified as possibilities. However, I think that none of those viri have stood up to scientific scrutiny. About diamonds, I need to just say, like, you guys seem to be under the impression that diamond prices are determined by the number of diamonds in existence, which is not true.
A factor, not the factor.
Not really.
It's all the beers. They guarantee. They give you a guarantee of what its future worth is going to be. It's totally propped up.
Yeah, the number of diamonds is just, I mean, the number of diamonds on the market is just strictly controlled by companies. Yeah, De Beers. But that's what makes this an even more amazing news item, is because it's not like there were just a couple of diamonds in the world and now they found 10 times as many in a crater. It's that there were already a massive number of diamonds in the world. And now they've found 10 times as many. So it's an awesome discovery, if it's true, and I think it is. And the idea that SAT scores are good predictors of later college performance, that matches with my experience. I am a good test taker, and that's pretty much all college was. So I think SATs are given at a late enough date just before some. I mean, you're talking like a year to 2 years before someone enters college. If they can study for an SAT, if they can pass get a good score on an SAT, then yeah, I think that it would be a very good predictor of how well they do in college. So, I think it's the chronic fatigue syndrome. I think that, actually the opposite is true in that I think that what scientists have found is that the viruses they've been looking at do not cause chronic fatigue syndrome.
All right. A good spread across all three. I like that. Let's take these in reverse order. A large study of SAT scores finds that they are good predictors of later college performance across socioeconomic status. Jay, you think this one is the fiction?
Oh, boy.
Everyone else thinks that this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay. So the controversy was that, SAT scores are absolutely testing for something, you know, and it makes sense that they would correlate with, you know, it's an academic test. Why wouldn't it correlate with academic performance? But it's always been criticized because it plays such a large role in access to competitive colleges. There were a lot of people who were very critical of it, said that it discriminated against people from lower socioeconomic classes, you know, just because of the nature of the test itself. But recent research finds that, in fact, it has the same predictive ability of later college performance, regardless of socioeconomic status.
But wait, that doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't work against people of lower socioeconomic status. It could just mean that both the SAT and college are more difficult for people of lower socioeconomic status.
Hold on there. The research also found, not done yet, that... So they also found that the socioeconomic status of students who are enrolled in college was very similar to the socioeconomic status of students who were applying to college. So there wasn't a filter between applying and getting in. It's just that people with a lower socioeconomic status were not applying to college in the same numbers. So you can't blame any of the filter, you know, like the SAT scores or anything for like not keeping them out of college. They're just not applying. So the research strongly suggests that there, not only there's no correlation between socioeconomic status and performance on SATs, or the predictive power of SATs on college performance, but it also does not seem to be a barrier to students getting into college. That there's something else that's going on. You know, they're just, they don't see it, they don't have it or see it as an opportunity.
Or they're not able to because they can't afford college.
Well, yeah, they don't have the opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. So, but it's not the SATs. It's not the, according to this research, they're not being kept out by an unfair SAT system. It seems to be working the same way across socioeconomic status. All right, let's continue to work our way backwards. Russian scientists announced an earlier discovery of a massive deposit of diamonds estimated at trillions of carats, or 10 times existing world reserves, in a large Siberian meteor crater. Bob, you think this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh.
Oh.
Very
wow.
Cool.
Science.
Holy crap.
This one's been out there. Some of you might have read this.
Apparently.
This was actually discovered in the late 1970s by Soviet scientists. And they deliberately sat on this for the last 40 years because they were making a killing in selling synthetic diamonds.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
Same market forces at work.
Absolutely. So there's a couple of interesting tidbits here. Evan, you hit upon the fact that these are likely to be impact diamonds, actually produced by the meteor strike, which was about 35 million years old. Now, the articles I read about it, one of the articles said that you see large numbers of impact diamonds when a meteor strikes an existing diamond mine or diamond deposit, I should say.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. I guess it's because the conditions are already correct in terms of the carbon and whatnot, and then the pressure and the heat of the impact just accelerates the process and makes a ton of diamonds. Another interesting thing about these diamonds is that they are not gem quality, so they will not disrupt the jewelry market.
There you go.
But they are very useful for industrial use. So these are industrial grade diamonds.
In fact,
they're excellent industrial grade diamonds because a couple of reports said that they're like harder than your average diamond. I thought diamonds were diamonds in terms of a hard, maybe because of fewer impurities or whatever, but they're particularly hard diamonds. So that's good for industrial use. And they're particularly large because of the way that they formed. You get these nice large crystals. While this won't lower the price of your diamond necklace or ring, this will provide so many large, hard diamonds for potential industrial use that this could have an impact on several industries. Yeah, it would actually may alter their practice based upon the availability of this huge resource now. So, you know, industrial diamonds are suddenly affordable to a lot more uses, a lot more industries than they otherwise would have been. So very, very interesting.
I wonder what other countries are sitting on for the past 40 years.
Yeah, right.
UFOs, perhaps?
Right.
Right? Mostly just human rights abuses. Boo.
Yeah, nice.
Baby powder pills.
When you think about it, this was a conspiracy to cover up the existence of a massive diamond find for the last 40 years.
So, you know, Soviet Union 40 years ago.
Yes. Yeah. Which means a new study finds that more than 30% of patients who meet strict criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome are infected with the XMRV virus. That news item is fiction. And thank you, Bob. I thought the 30% figure was perfect.
Yeah, you bastard.
And Rebecca, so you're correct. The research showed no correlation, no association. In fact, there was zero evidence of the XMRV or the PMLV virus in patients meeting criteria for chronic fatigue syndrome. This was a huge controversy, the XMRV controversy, because there was a study published earlier showing the potential existence of XMRV in some patients with chronic fatigue syndrome or CFS. And the CFS community seized upon this and said, aha, we're not crazy. This is a real disease. You have a real cause. It's a viral infection. We want antiviral medication to be treated for it. Scientific community was like, not so fast. I mean, this is an interesting finding, but we need to confirm it. There was a follow-up study, which was negative, but was not really large enough to be definitive. So then there was, you know, the controversy heated up. So you had the two camps, those listening to the first study, which was preliminary, those listening to the second study, which was preliminary and negative. So science, in this case, I think worked the way it's supposed to work. They got together. They did a consensus trial with a lot of subjects. You fix all the problems that both sides are pointing at in the other study, you know, and so you have a study that fixes all the problems and it's as ironclad as we can make it. They used really good strict criteria for deciding who has chronic fatigue syndrome. They used very sensitive techniques for looking for these viruses. They had blinded controls. They sent known positives and known negatives to the labs to make sure that their assays were working. All the ducks were in a row, and zero XMRV and PMLV. So this really,
that's it.
You know, as much as one study can, this is a so-called consensus trial. This pretty much kills the XMRV controversy in terms of chronic fatigue syndrome. I doubt this will end the public controversy. There's just, you know, too many people, I think, invested too much in this. There's now it's just the conspiracy theories will come out of the woodwork. But the research, in terms of scientific researchers, it's done. So one of the original researchers that found the possible link with XMRV, Ian Lipkin, who was involved in the study, is quoted as saying, although the once promising XMRV and PMLV hypothesis has been excluded, the consequences of the early reports linking these viruses to disease are that new resources and investigators have been recruited to address the challenge of CFS/ME. So he's basically saying, okay, so my hypothesis was wrong, but at least it cast more attention on this very challenging disease. Okay, we'll give him that. But he is accepting the results of this study and accepting the death of the XMRV and PMLV hypotheses.
Which is good because, I mean, were he a different personality, we would have immediately like another Andrew Wakefield.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly. You always wonder which way they're going to go when the nail is in the coffin of their hypothesis. Do they become a crank and champion the community who wants to believe in this or deny it or whatever? Or are they going to accept the science, you know, stay true to their creed and give up on their favorite hypothesis? You always wonder, and you see scientists go either way. You have the Andrew Wakefields, although I think he's, you know, my opinion was he was a little more of a crank from the beginning. There are scientists who, when the moment of truth comes, they just can't let go of their hypothesis. Yeah.
Or they just see a lot of money to be made.
You know, yeah, that's what I mean. I think
I
think it was more of the Andrew Wakefield. That's what I was sort of getting at with Wakefield. But there's like the Pons and Fleischmann, you know, who decided to say, nope, there really is cold fusion. We were right, even though the rest of the community disagreed with us. So good work, Evan and Rebecca.
Hey.
You guys were right this week.
Thank you.
Thank you. And one raspberry. Raspberry.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote sent in by a listener named Tyler Davis from New Zealand. The quote is, the most important service rendered by the press and the magazines is that of educating people to approach printed matter with distrust. That's from Samuel Butler.
That's a good quote. A little cynical, but I think it's true. You need to have a healthy skepticism towards anything claimed in the news, printed, or heard on TV, whatever.
Samuel Butler!
Thank you, Jay.
Mm-hmm. I have something very cool and important that I think I want to share with our audience. There is a 6-year-old boy named Zach who likes to play science or fiction along with us. And not too long ago, while Zach's dad was driving him around in the car and they were listening to the show, Zach said, "Peanut butter is definitely the fake, Dad. Which one are you voting for?"
And he was right.
That's right. So his dad said that he was going to email us and see if we can all basically say hi to him and say his name on the show. So, Zach, this is your shout-out from the SGU. We love the fact that you're listening to the show. We want you to continue listening to our show and win at Science or Fiction and become a professional skeptic.
You have to have a better record than Bob by the end of the year if that's your mission. So you have to pay attention and read science every day. All right. Well, thanks for listening to the show, Zach.
Thanks,
and,
Zach.
Zach,
and thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
God bless
nothing
you.
Nothing better to do.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.